भद्रं धरणे पिश्नुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षधीर्यचक्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टु वागुंसस्तु नूभिः त्यशेम देवहितन्यतायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्धातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
So we're on verse 29, which is the last verse of the Agama Prakarana, the first chapter. So just repeat after me.
Amatro nantamatrascha, amatro nantamatrascha, dvaitasyo prashamashivaha, dvaitasyo prashamashivaha. Omkaro vidito yena, omkaro vidito yena, samunira netaro janaha, samunira netaro janaha. Amatraha, anantamatraha cha, so amatraha, ananta matraha cha, dvaitasya upashamaha shivaha, omkaraha, viditah yena saha munihi na itaraha janah. Okay.
So this whole last section is on Turiya, the last verses of the Agama Prakarana, the last Karika verses are on the Turiya. Turiya means the fourth quarter, the a-u-m. That silence, that silence is called a mantra, where there is no mantra, there's no limitation. The akara is limited, right? It's a sound. It's the comes into manifestation and goes out of manifestation, so that itself is circumscribed. The u is circumscribed, so u. The makara is circumscribed, comes into being, goes out of being. One replaces the other. The a is replaced by the u is replaced by the makara. But the silence from which the om, the a u m, comes and into which it resolves, right, is not circumscribed. There's no limitation to it. So a mantra, that a negates the mantra, it negates the limitation of the sound, the differentiation of the sound. Every sound is differentiated, right? And so one differentiated sound is replaced by another differentiated sound, is replaced by another differentiated sound. So every sound is circumscribed. Silence is not. Silence doesn't have a beginning or an end. In fact, we think initially that a sound displaces silence. But actually, a sound takes place in silence. So that's why, in fact, it seems so simple, but one of the first meditations I do in class at school, because some of the young students are not familiar with anything, they're not even familiar with meditation, some of the ones have just come from high school. And so it's very interesting just to sit in silence and to listen to the sounds. Even right now, you can listen to the sounds outside. All the sounds are taking place in silence. Right? You can always differentiate the silence from the sound. If you couldn't differentiate the silence from the sound, you wouldn't be able to hear the sound. But sound takes place in silence. It actually takes place in the silence of your being, the silence of awareness, the silence of consciousness. And so every sound rises and sets in silence. In fact, every vritti rises and sets, every thought modification rises and sets in silence, every perception rises and sets in silence, but I would say in the silence which is awareness. Awareness itself doesn't have any sound. Sound is objectified. This is so important when we're getting into now that what we call satya mitya. What is the adhishtana, or what is actually there as the support, as the being for which supports things that come into being and go out of being. That which supports things that go into being, come into being and go out of being, can't itself be subject to time. Right? Because if it's subject to time, itself comes into being and goes out of being. So that all, what is not subject to time has got to be something non-objectifiable, something not existing within the experienced world. Anything that's experienced, anything that exists within time and space on either a subtle level or on a physical level is existing within the experienced world and by its nature is objectifiable. Consciousness, conscious being, which is really the me, is not an object that we can look at. We can objectify the body or the mind or the sense organs, thoughts, sounds, perceptions. Anything that exists within duality has an intrinsic quality to it, is that it can be known, it can be objectified, it's subject to subject-object differentiation. But it's only something that can't be objectified, that doesn't exist as an object, right, that isn't subject to time. Yeah. Anything in the creation is subject to time and change and differentiation, division. In fact, we say that anything that we experience in the creation is by its very nature, because it's objectifiable, is something, because it's bound by time, is something that comes into being and goes out of being. And also, when we go into analyzing anything that we perceive, but internally or externally, Shankara is going to say this, doesn't make any difference whether it's internal perception or external perception, that perception, anything by the very nature of being a drisha, is infinitely divisible. That's why Swamiji always goes, it's just names within names within names. You can take any object that you perceive and divide it into parts. And then you can take those objects and divide those into parts. So what happens is, when we start analyzing this physical creation, we recognize what we call the mityatva of it. We say mityatva of it, that meaning that the being that this creation enjoys doesn't belong to it. Because, first of all, there's two reasons, and you can apply this reasoning. It's called yukti. You can apply this yukti to any experience that you have, this logic to any experience that you have. Anything that is objectifiable is by its nature time-bound. If it's time-bound, it's bordered by non-existence. Comes into being, is circumscribed, like the is circumscribed. Its presence is circumscribed by its absence. If the presence of something is circumscribed by its absence, you say, another way, stronger way to say it, if the presence of any experience is circumscribed by its non-existence, its non-being, then it doesn't really have any being in the middle. Because by its nature, by its very nature, it's going to be non-being or non-existent. Because something can't come from non-existence, first of all. Nor can, can't come from non-existence, because non-existence isn't there. And so when you experience something that has a prior non-existence and a posterior non-existence, that thing can't have any existence in the middle. And yet it is enjoying existence. It is enjoying being. And that being that it's enjoying is of a different order of reality. That being that it enjoys, in the end, can't be something that is objectifiable. Because if it is, then it suffers from the same problem of not having any existence of its own. And so, in the end of our analysis of this creation, we get to what we call the adhishtana. It's a different order of reality, the being which everything enjoys. The being which everything enjoys includes the being which I enjoy, which is interesting to play on words. If I say the being which I enjoy, we only start there. The being which I enjoy, the being which this body enjoys. The being which this body enjoys, which I've taken to be me. The being which my sense organs enjoy, which I've taken to be me. the being which my mind enjoys, which I've taken to be me. But all of these things come into being and go out of being. The only thing, therefore, that doesn't come into being and out of being has got to be there, first of all. It's got to be there, or all of this is non-existent. Right? If there's no existence to be found here, because everything is bordered by non-existence, then we are not having an experience here. Because there's nothing here. You have to take non-existence, not as shunya, but take it as shunya. Take non-existence as non-existence. Non-existence means like the son of a barren woman, or the rabbit horn, tuchim, that which is absolutely not here. What is absolutely not here is a non-experience. There is no being. That's what we mean by that's when we say non-existence. That's what we mean. There is no being. We can never have such an experience. Every experience that we have is filled to the brim with being. Just like a clay pot is filled to the brim with clay, like that, every experience that we have is filled to the brim with being. There is no experience that's apart from that. But the being that is the very adhishtana of all of this, you know, has to be recognized in and of its in its own right. We have to recognize it in its own right. We have to recognize what is mithya, what is dependent upon being, and what is satyam, the being itself. And that's going to go true for the whole creation that we experience, as well as this body, which belongs to the creation, my sense organs, which belong to the creation, mind that belongs to the creation, right? Because all objectifiable. The I thought that belongs to the creation, anything objectifiable exists within duality. So if it exists within duality, it has no being of its own. If it exists within duality, it comes into being and goes out of being. So it's mithya. That's all it needs to be mithya. Mithya means it comes into being and goes out of being, subject to change, it's mithya. Mithya means for it even to be present, it has to depend upon something for its reality, for its being. And so here in our experience, everything that we experience is mithya, except for one thing. Now, when I say that, it's that there's a tremendous truth here. See, every single thing that I experience in this creation, subtle and physical, anything that can be objectified, anything that exists within time and space, by its nature, has to be mithya, because it's subject to change. Anything subject to change can't be satyam, because it can't be true, can't be real, because it negates. It's a momentary negation. Every moment is a negation of the prior moment, because it's not the same. The prior moment is not the same as this moment. And so the whole creation gets reduced to mithya, and we say it gets reduced to mithya because it's not non-existent. It enjoys being. If it didn't enjoy, and the being it can't have. It can't have being because it comes into being and goes out of being. So either it is not, and there is no experience here, or it's mithya enjoying a being which itself doesn't exist in this order of reality. It's not subject to time and space. So that's true for the whole creation. And this body, mind, sense organs is part of the whole creation and is objectifiable, right? Is known. The body is known, the sense organs are known, the mind is known, the emotions are known, the moods are known, the thoughts are known, the ahankara, the I notion is known, memories are known. Everything that comes your way is known. Everything that's bound by change, that is known. So now, this objectifiable knownness, this objectifiable knownness takes place, or we say, is enjoys a being, because it is, it enjoys a being which can't be objectifiable. And so if I look at that in terms of this body, mind, sense organs, this body is, enjoys being, it is a conscious being, I'll even say. It enjoys being. My mind enjoys being. My body is known. It is and it is known. Right? The sense organs, they are and they are known. They exist and they are known. The mind is and it is known. Let me put it a little differently. The body, as long as it is here, is and is known, because subject to change. The mind, as long as it is here and is known. Right? Sense organs, as long as they are here functioning, they are and they are known. Every mood is and is known. Even the I thought is and is known. Memories, they are and they are known. Right? But all of these are continually changing in this is-knownness. The is-knownness that all of the experiences enjoy is of a different order of reality, because it's only your isness, your being, and the knownness of your being, the consciousness of your being, the conscious being, that is steady, is not objectifiable, is not subject that is taking place, is not something taking place in duality, but is the very adhishtana, the very thing with the whole creation, in fact, depends upon. Because it's not just your body, mind, sense organs that enjoys being and knownness. It's every experience. It's the wall, it's the plant, it's the painting, it's each one of you. Everything objectified enjoys the same is knownness, the same being. And that being is what we call, what we refer to as I, my amness, my consciousness. I am a conscious being. That I am a conscious being is not, in fact, objectifiable as being in the form of this body. This body takes place in conscious being. This mind takes place in conscious being. I can say like this, this body takes place in me, conscious being. The sense organs take place and do their functioning in me, conscious being. The mind takes place in me, conscious being. But I am not an object to be objectified with another conscious being behind it, to objectify it. Right? And so this me, the me that I am, I take it from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, to be circumscribed, to be in the form of this body, to be in the form of the body, mind, to be in the form of the body, mind, sense organs. That becomes me. That's the mind talking. The circumscribed mind that is always and never away from awareness is defining non-objectifiable me, taking it to be itself, and then I become an entity in this creation. That's from the standpoint of the mind. But from the standpoint of me, non-objectifiable me, I am the being that everything enjoys. I am the knownness that everything enjoys. This wall is. There is no experience that doesn't enjoy me, non-objectifiable me. There's no experience that is not lit by knownness. It is known, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. But the knownness doesn't belong to it. The knownness, consciousness, the me consciousness is not an object in the creation. It is the very self, it is the very me that everything enjoys. So, a whole creation, I'm in the waking state, this whole creation, including this body, mind, sense organs, enjoys non-objectifiable me. Because I don't exist as an object in time and space. So time and space exist in me, I don't exist in it. The waking state is knocked off by the dream state. So the dream state now exists in me. I don't exist in it. It exists in me. I'm its being. I'm its adhishtana. It has no... Adhishtana means the very, very being which something that has no being of its own depends upon. Kind of like their snake rope. Snake depends for its being on the rope. All of this has no being of its own, but it has only being. There is no moment that is not pervaded by being. But being isn't an object like space going out and pervading everything. It's just that what is enjoys me. Dimension enjoys me. Right? Change enjoys me. Dimension means space. The whole space takes place in me. Like if you have an imagination, the imagination is spatial. The whole imagination, three-dimensional space, takes place in me. That's why I can say, you know, the wall is known and this intervening space is known, this body is known, sense organs are known, mind is known. There's nothing that's not known. But that knownness is my only myself experience. I am also known. There's nothing separate from it. So this Dehatma Bhuti, this identification of me, this non-objectifiable being, has to be differentiated from everything that comes, that manifests within it, so to speak. And so when they're doing now the Omkara, remember the Om, the A is this physical, the A U-M. This A is the physical universe and the Jiva, the individual within it. The A rises in silence in the Amatra. It rises, means this creation includes this body, mind, and sense organs. It rises in Satchit. Satchit is denoted by the silence in which the Omkara takes place. In A, U, M. So if I say Om, 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 to be complete in understanding the Omkara, and I say Om, 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 I cannot not acknowledge the silence in which it's taking place. If I say Om, the silence is a part of that. It runs through the Om, and it is what is left when the Om, it's there before, during, and after the rising and setting of the Om. It's the very, that silence is the very Adhishtana from which the Om rises and sets. Mm. Right, so you can't leave it out. Because when you say Om, this Om is the name for Ishwara. Right? Ishwara, the Lord, God, is Brahman, conscious being, plus this Maya that's responsible for the projection of the creation. Conscious being is silent. Conscious being is free from time and space. It's free from time, it's free from sound. Right? It's free from objectivity. But objectivity and sound, the creation itself, is totally dependent on it. Because if you take away the silent conscious being, if you take away being from the creation, what do you have? Non-being. And so this creation isn't even here without existence. That's why if you go into analyzing this creation, what you find is that you can't find any existence here. You can't find a thing here to say that it exists. Because everything is subject to time, everything is infinitely divisible. There's no thing. And that goes on infinitely. It's absolutely impossible to find a thing. Every form is made of smaller forms, it's made of smaller forms, it's made of smaller forms. So finally you have to say, well, let me take the form off. Let me just take the form off. Of the smallest form, you have to take the form off. Well, then there's no form. It's formless. Formless is not a thing. It's not objectifiable. The formlessness is the very being which all things enjoy. Now, that means that the very being that this thing enjoys is the me which is formless. If it's formless, it belongs. If I'm not formless, I'm an object in the creation. And then I don't exist. Right? Because I come into being and go out of being. So this me that is formless, it has to be, the me that is formless, it has to be formless. It has to be free from form. Or it's subject to birth and death. But if I am free from form and non-objectifiable, then there can only be one of me. There's only one of me, first of all, because I'm not objectifiable to be divided by space or time. And there's only one of me because in reference to this creation, there's no second thing because this creation has no being apart from me. And so I am. That's right. You know, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in Genesis, it says, I am that I am. That's so perfect. I am that I am. What else can you say? There is nothing, no one else here. There is no one else here because there's only one being. There's only one conscious being, and that conscious being is me. And so what that means is that this me that I am, because non-objectifiable, is not circumscribed in any way. It can't be. It can't be because there's not two. You can't objectify it to have it be divided by time or space or objectivity. And this doesn't have, this creation doesn't have time, doesn't have being of its own. So it can't compete. It's not like there's me and this. This has no self apart from me. No sat, no existence. So all there is really is me. But when we say the word me, the me word is so identified with this body, mind, sense organs that we don't really understand. You can immediately fall back into the me being this body, mind, sense organs. I'm saying, yes, the me is this body, mind, sense organs, and 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 the whole creation. Because the whole creation, all of it is infinitely divisible. It has, you can't find a thing here, and it's subject to change, so it has no being. So all of this, the being that this enjoys, all of it is the non-objectifiable me, which is non-divisible. What can't be objectified has no parts. It's non-divisible. So I am not divisible. I'm not big, and I'm not small. I'm not tall or short. These things absolutely don't apply. You need space for these type of concepts. Yeah. I'm not black or white or blue. You need objectivity for these type of color schemes. You know, I'm not feminine or masculine. I'm feminine and masculine and in between. To talk like that, I have to be identified with something in the creation. You might as well just say, I'm everything that is, and I'm free of everything that is. I'm everything that is because everything that is, all of this, everything that exists within duality on every dimension, has no being apart from me. So I'm everything that is, but because this that comes into being and goes out of being has no being of its own, it can't touch me because it has no being of its own. It's not equal. It's not an equal relationship. You know? This depends upon me. I am its truth. And so all of this is me, and I am free of it. This is what we mean by the satya mitya. And now, this is our experience anyway. This is our, every moment of our day is only this experience. Because all of your experiences are coming and going in you. You are not negated by your experience. You can identify with the experience and become afraid of the experience. But you're always there, and the experience continues to move on. Doesn't matter what it is. On every level, experiences are moving on because they can't help themselves. It's the nature of creation, right? Everything objectifiable is moving on. You can't stop it. But you are not moving on. Conscious being is not moving on. It can't move on because it's not objectifiable. It's not within time and space. So you are the constant. So that's why in a lot of these meditations we've been doing lately is just, you know, relaxing. Let the body, the mind, the sense organs, everything that has the ability to relax, because it's within duality, every part of your upadis, these conditioning adjuncts that you take to be you, let all of those relax on every level. Because by deep relaxation of these upadis, they become as though invisible. Because they're not calling your attention. You're not clinging. There's no clinging in any way. There's just a complete letting go, not pushing away, It's a letting go of in a total acceptance of what is. And in doing that, this Maya experience becomes thin, because it's not grabbing your mind. It's not grabbing you emotionally. There's nobody clinging to it. And so when you're like that, when that's the experience, that's the experience of Ishwara. That's Ishwara. That's God. In the sense, this whole manifest creation is simply allowed to be as it is, and without any that jivatvam of I need this and I need that and I need that, creating all this havoc. That is, for the time, you just totally, completely let go of that, so that there is no havoc. There's just the Maya, which has for its being, as its very self, as the totality of its being itself, that comes to the forefront. You, that which cannot be objectified, becomes much more, you become much more awake to it. Your mind becomes much more awake to it, because your mind has just let go. It's not creating any type of diversity or problems. And it just gives you a chance to recognize who you are without any distraction. Because the mind isn't creating any waves, so it's just your being, this me that you are, that comes forward. You come forward, because this Maya is not, the Maya mind is not full of, you know, waves. So you become forward. This is Nididhyasana. You recognize that the depth of the changeless being that you are, that nothing can change you, nothing can touch you. You've always been this, you always will be this. Nobody can ever do anything about it. And you are the very wholeness which the whole creation enjoys. It becomes what we call a paroksha. It becomes obvious. That self is what is here in this verse called amatra. It has no limitation. It's ananta. It's without end. Conscious being, you are without end. Now, that doesn't mean you're big like space, or small like a little tiny bitty square of space. It has nothing to do with big or small. It has to do with being limitless. There's no end. It's not about dimension. It means that there is nothing but you. Limitless, infinite means, if you think spatially infinite, then you need time and space. Time and space comes with the creation. But what is Advaita, non-dual, has no dimension. It doesn't have a right side and a left side, because there's not two. There is just one, and there is nothing else. And so it's not about any longer big or small. It's just about me. The word that we use, me. When you're contemplating and just relaxing and being with your own being, let your mind ask yourself, am I big or small? Am I tall or short? Am I a color? Ask these questions. They just fall off. The questions are totally irrelevant. You'll have to say, no, I'm not big or small. It's not because I'm not big or small. It's because these words don't work. These words don't talk about the infinite, what is infinite. So he says, this amatra is ananta, it's limitless, and it's dvaitasya upashamaha. It's where all of duality resolves. In conscious being, there is no duality. It is the self of all duality, but from its own standpoint, there is no dvaita at all. There is no second thing. What is mithya can never be a second thing, because mithya, it's like saying, is the pot a separate thing from the clay? Do we have for a clay pot, do we have pot and clay? No, there's only pot there. And so here we have to say, there's only me here. There's only conscious being here. There is, in fact, no duality at all, because what is actually here, if you look at this room and you see a display of of names and forms and colors and dimension is such a display. But what if the substance of this display is only one thing? Then there's only one thing here. Right? Say you have a very ornate bas-relief sculpture out of a block of clay. Very ornate, a whole city carved into the block of clay. All of the carvings are mithya. And there's only one clay there. So all of this is an innate, a very ornate room. When you think of it, when you look at all of the color and everything that's going on in this room, it's so full of complexity and color and diversity. But are there two things here? You could say there's a mithya display, but there's only one being. That's what we mean by Advaita. And so all of this duality resolves. When I say resolves, this is another tricky thing. He'll be getting into it later. When I say resolves, it doesn't have to go away. To resolve, it doesn't need to go away. Its presence here and its perception through your eyes and your ears, etc., doesn't make it two. What makes it two is for there to be two things here. And so what if you recognize what is actually here? The non-objectifiable sat-chit, conscious being, which is the self of everything that you experience, because it's very clear to you that everything that you experience has no being apart from it. And you can differentiate the sat-chit, your own being, as the pervasive subject, of everything that's objectified. Pervasive subject, maybe that's misleading. What I'm saying is the conscious being which everything the knownness which everything enjoys is consciousness. The being which everything enjoys is consciousness. So that sat-chit that everything enjoys is myself. And that is, what is its nature? Is Shiva. Shiva means, so he says, that dvaitasya upashamaha, that is Shiva. That Shiva means that which is auspicious. There is nothing more dear to you or to any being than their own being. You don't want dukkha, you don't want sorrow, you don't want suffering. But you would say, I don't want suffering, I don't want sorrow. I don't want it anywhere near me. I want me. I want me, I want my being to be free of all of these things. But I don't want to be free of me. I want me to be free of all of these things. That's why sleep is such a joy. Sleep is Shiva. When you go to sleep, the whole manifest creation is resolved. Even the subject-object duality. There's nobody even in deep sleep, such a wonderful thing. There's nobody even saying, oh look, I'm deep sleeping, isn't this great? That person is gone, you know? And it is a cherished state. Deep sleep is a cherished state, especially if you're like some of us who don't get it that often. That very deep sleep is such a very, very wonderful thing. It's like the lazy man's samadhi, I call it. Yeah. Because there's just a total resolution, and it's just your being. There's nothing more dear. It's Shiva. What is the most beloved is my own being. Everything that we do, in fact, there's verses like this in the Upanishads. Everything, the sense organs are just continually offering. They're offering as though flowers. Every perception is like an offering to the Lord, to consciousness. Every perception that comes in, it's as though offering petals. You know, in the when you do a puja, you're offering petals and ghee and chandan, sandalwood, so many things, yogurt, curds, so many things you're offering to the deity. Like that, for you, all of these things are, all of the sense organs are continually offering. Everything that you do is continually being offered for the sake of the self. There's beautiful verses like that. So that self, which is where all duality resolves, that self is Shiva. Then it says, the omkaraha viditaha yena, by whom this omkara is known, the a-u-m, all have their reality in that amatra, the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, all have their being in me, in Brahman, the one by whom this omkara is known, saha munihi, that person, that one is a muni, means that person knows. That person is a wise person. Na itaraha janaha, not any other person. Janaha means a person. Na itaraha, not another jana, not another person. Only the person who knows this. That Shiva, the amatra, the one who is the self, the truth of all duality. The one who knows that, that person knows, not anybody else. And so then Shankara was thinking, he commented, well, what do they mean by not another person? Why does Gaudapada have to say that? Who's he talking about? And so Shankara, he says, na itaraha janaha, not another person means what? A shastravid api ityartha, not even a shastravid. What he's saying is that you can study the shastra. You can study all the Upanishads and all of the Prakarana Granthas, all the explanatory texts and all of the commentaries.
Mm.
Know them backwards and forwards.
Mm.
That doesn't necessarily mean you know. To know means that the Upanishads have to have functioned as a pramana, as a means of knowledge for you. And the type of knowledge is what type of knowledge? It's a direct, immediate recognition of your being. Right? So the Upanishads themselves are pramanas, are a means of knowledge to take the student step by step by step to a recognition of what's being talked about. Because the Atma, the self that you are, is present. They're not talking in the third person about somebody who's not present at the moment. They're talking about your being that is here right now. They're talking about this creation that is being experienced. You know, and so everything that the Upanishad has to say is holding up a mirror to this reality, subject-object reality that you find yourself in, and taking it apart for you, holding up a mirror for you so that you can recognize yourself. And so unless the Upanishad has functioned in that way for you, you may be able to recite all the Upanishads and recite all of the commentaries also. Just India, that's frighteningly common. Somebody could even have a memory like that, where they know all of these texts by heart and the commentaries. You know, including Swamiji. It's like that. It's unbelievable. But that doesn't make you a jnani. It makes you a pundit. It means they can... You can ask them what one any verse. Wasn't there some verse like this? What was that? And then they'll just, you know, even if you just vaguely describe it, they'll just chant it right away. And then and there's another one in this Upanishad that's similar. Yeah, it's something incredible. But they need not. They can do all of that and not have knowledge, because to have knowledge, these Upanishads have had to function as a pramana. It's a means of knowledge.
Mm.
Swamiji himself said that he had studied all of these. He knew every Upanishad, every Prakarana Granta, every text, the Brahma Sutras. He'd studied them till his hair fell out. He said, he's bald. And then he said then he would joke and say, I meditated so much that I think the heat burned out my hair. But he didn't have knowledge at all. He was suffering. He was suffering because he had studied and studied and studied and, you know. And then he went to that one Swami who had just three Swamiji. Used to make a joke about him with great respect and reverence. He had three lectures, this Swami. Three. Yeah. But for that Swami, the Upanishads were pramana. And so he unfolded it as a pramana. And then Swamiji saw it. He saw it, and then when he went back and he read all the Upanishads and all the commentaries, and it's all over. He said he couldn't, there's no place where he didn't see what he was talking about. But until he saw it, he couldn't see it. Because until you see it, you're defining the words that are used within duality. Right? So these words have to be handled. They have to be juxtaposed one by next to the other to break through the duality and be pointing. And the reason that they can work and do work is because you are present. You are here. The self that they're talking about is here to be recognized. And the maya, the mitya of this creation is here to be recognized. And so what happens for when the listening is, when that teaching is handled as a pramana and the student is receiving it as a pramana, that's why you have to teach that it's a pramana. Mm. You have to teach the students how to listen also. Mm. Or they'll just be listening to a lecture. Mm. All these things, every part of this has to be unfolded. But when the student, when the teacher is teaching as a pramana and the student is listening to a pramana, you see it, and you see it, and you see it. And then you'll hit a boulder of a doubt. And then some teaching will go on, and you'll ask questions and whatnot, and then you'll see that, which has a ripple effect, you know, it's like a domino effect. You see this, and then these things make sense. You see this, and then these things make sense. But it's an actual scene. It's a scene of what's being talked about here. It's not just an intellectual lecture. It's things to be recognized. And those recognitions that take place during Shravana, during the listening, during the unfoldment, are what Nididhyasana is done on. Nididhyasana, contemplation, is upon the things that you have recognized and understood in Shravana, during the unfoldment. In Vedanta, Nididhyasana is not meditation for an experience. Say you're meditating with the hopes of gaining an enlightenment experience of some sort. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what many times we think of meditation like that. You meditate in order to attain a state of realization. But that isn't what it is with Vedanta. With Vedanta, that scene takes place at the time of teaching. And Nididhyasana is meant to give your mind a time to sit with that, because the dehatma buddhi, that identification with the body, is so much, you know, that you walk out of the class, you know, it's like the reeds are open during the class, and you walk out of the class and the reeds, you know, snap back by the time you're down the stairs. And so Nididhyasana allows your mind to sit with your own, with your being, sit with what you know. That's why, you know, they'll do japa and pranayama and things to get into a meditative state, a contemplative state. And then for Nididhyasana, they'll introduce something, some sort of mantra like I am a sanghoham, I am a sangha, I am free of attachment, because I know what a sangha means. I am consciousness. I'm Chaitanyoham, I'm consciousness. Because I know what consciousness means. Imagine meditating on consciousness when you don't have a clue what consciousness means. It's just what it means in the world, whatever you think it means. Now it has to, consciousness, Chaitanya, has to have been revealed what that means. Then you can contemplate on it. Or Anandoham, I am wholeness, I am fullness. Ishwaroham, I am Ishwara, I am the Lord. These are all wonderful to sit with, if you know what they mean. And the only reason you use a word like that, like I am a sangha, something like that, is just to help the mind just to bring it back. Bring it back. Not with any force. Just resolve it. Resolve your mind into the meaning of that word. So you could say asangoham, you resolve into the truth of it. You resolve into the truth of it. Like that. If the mind starts wandering over, then you just bring in another. Just to give their mind a chance to get to know you. Because it's used to being you, not getting to know you. Then when the mind is being you, then when the mind is unhappy, I am unhappy. The mind is happy, I'm finally happy. The mind is agitated or angry, I'm agitated. So when the mind, you give the mind a chance to get to know you, then the mind, the mitya mind, comes into relationship with its own satyam, with its own truth, you know, with its adhishtana. It's very beautiful. That's why we do nididhyasana, because then as you get to know yourself, yourself becomes predominant in every moment of your experience. It's silly. You already are totally predominant. You are the dominant factor in every moment of your experience, just like the clay is the dominant factor of the pot. Mm. You wouldn't think the pot would have a hard time coming into relationship with the clay. But that's what we have here. Mm. This, the totality of our experience, you know, it, there comes a time when my being is the self of it. It's not that there's no dehatma buddhi, that's mitya though, this body enjoys me, the mind enjoys me, the sense organs enjoy me, but my me, the me that I am, you know, is not separate from any, but the totality of my experience. You're not bound. Yourself is not bound. The entire creation enjoys you. There's no limitation on you. It enjoys you, and at the same time, you're free of it. That's the satyam mitya. So that's the whole teaching. The, and so the muni is the one when you. So now he's done this agama prakarana. Agama prakarana means the chapter. Prakarana is chapter. That deals with the agama. Agama is another name for the shruti. For the, so the agama prakarana is the chapter that contains in it the Upanishad. So this first chapter, the Mandukya, is four chapters. Mandukya Kadika is four chapters. The first chapter is done now because this, the section on just dealing with the meaning of the Upanishad is there, is done. We're going to go, next week we'll start, into the Vaitatya Prakarana. This is the way he's doing this. Is first now, having gone through the whole Omkara and showed the Adhishtana, you know, the Atma, the Chaturta, the fourth quarter, is the Adhishtana for the whole, is the substrate being for the whole waking, dream, and deep sleep state. That whole Upanishad's now been unfolded. Now in this satyam mitya, showing that the conscious being, the me, is the satyam, is the reality. And all of this, waking, dream, deep sleep state, and by waking I mean the whole waking universe and the waker in it, the dream, whole dream universe and the dreamer in it. The deep sleep is Ishvara, the causal condition, the maya in causal condition, that is the deep sleep state for the individual and the causal condition of the creation. For Ishvara. All of that is mitya. Yeah. And the fourth pada, the atma, the self, is satyam, is what is real, is the adhishtana. So now in the next chapter, the vaitatya prakarana, vaitatya means mitya. He establishes the mityatva, that mitya nature of this creation, feeling that without proving, it's not enough just that the Upanishad says it's mitya, that it's totally dependent for its being on sat, on existence, on Brahman. It wants to give all the logic for that. And he, Shankara, even starts out saying, to establish the mityatva means the nature of the creation. Logic is enough. Because the creation being mitya can't withstand your inquiry. And so you can bring in so much logic to dismiss the reality of the creation. By reality means it's not that it's an illusion or a delusion. That's not what we mean by reality. It means that the being that it enjoys can't belong to itself. That it must be dependent on being for it to be. That's what it means. That's why sometimes it's illusion, delusion, all of these words get thrown around and it's not appropriate. Yeah. It's that in this order of reality that here we find ourselves in, this order of reality is mithya because it depends for its being upon something else. And so that vaitatya, that mithyatva, he now wants to, in the second prakarana, in the second chapter, he wants to unfold that logically. Mm. So that's what we'll start. We'll start on that next week.
Okay.
So let's just take a moment. Purnamidachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti 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 Harihi. Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi. Om.
You know, after Swamiji did all that study, years and years of study and meditation, why do you think he didn't discover the Upanishads as a pramana after all of that?
Well, he did when they were taught as a pramana.
Pardon me?
Once they were taught as a pramana, he discovered it to be a pramana. But Sri Swamiji was more of a, didn't teach it as a pramana. He was more of a very, like Vivekananda, very inspiring teacher who went around and talked to the public. But he told Swamiji, you go sit somewhere and teach them for 3 years. That's what he used Swamiji for. Swamiji taught two or three three-year courses. But Sri Swamiji, who was his mula guru, and his root guru, where all his love and devotion was, He taught Vedanta more as Vivekananda in a very inspirational way, but not consciously as a pramana. Even though, it's interesting, I don't even know if he really knew the meaning of that word, pramana. But even though he wasn't that consistent in his unfoldment. But I remember when I was listening to him, he's the one that came over to the States and I listened to him first. He was my first introduction. And he used to tell so many stories, but with little pieces of Vedanta in between. You know? And I would wait so patiently, it'd be like 45 minutes would go. And I'd just be waiting, and then he would give this little piece of Vedanta. And I would see it because I was starving for it. You know, so if your mind is ready and you're all there, you know, when the little pieces that come, you know, you just swallow up.
But what puzzles me is that after he's discovered the Upanishads as a pramana, he could see it everywhere. That's the puzzling part.
Remember that pramana also means an authority. Like the Vedas, it's very well known. The Vedas are a pramana. They're an authority. What the Vedas have to say, they're revealed knowledge, they're authoritative, they're a pramana. You don't necessarily have to know that the pramanas, that the means of knowledge are called pramanas and that that's what they mean. Or that the Vedas are part of a teaching methodology. You're only going to know that the Upanishads are a teaching methodology if you're taught that, if you're part of that sampradaya.
Hmm. So there's no independent discovery of that.
Well, I suppose that there, possibly there could be, but there wasn't for Swamiji.
Yeah, yeah.
But when he did discover it, then he saw it everywhere.
Yeah.
You know? Which is interesting now for us that it was taught by Swamiji, because that discovering the Vedanta as a pramana was it was everything. It was that discovery that made everything fall into place. we never had that problem, because for Swamiji, since that was the primary, most meaningful thing that had made everything fall into place for him, he put a lot of emphasis on it. And so I could never say, oh, that was the most important to me, because I was never without it, right? Because that was pervasive in his teaching. So then you'll find for every student, every teacher, you know, something will have been the most important for you. For me, Ishwara was the most important. So Ishwara always is I always have always put a lot of emphasis on Ishwara, because that made everything work for me. If I didn't have the pramana, nothing would have worked. Right? But since I had that, then what was so important? And then Swamiji, one thing that he felt like he had developed very strongly for all of his students was Nididhyasana, guided meditation. He's talked about that. That was a great... And then he also saw how some of the verses in the Upanishads were really Nididhyasana. And so his guided meditations were so... and still are. His guided meditations are so beautiful.
They
really take you step by step by step, but he understood that about Nididhyasana. It's there in the Shastra. But for something to be there in the Shastra, you also have to see it there. You have to know it to see. So it has to be taught to you, or you have to somehow understand it. And then the meaning of it, the use of it, and all that. So Nididhyasana is something very beautiful.
Couldn't you say that the pramana wasn't taught as such?
Maybe unconsciously taught, but not consciously taught.
Not consciously taught. That seems to me it could mean a couple of different things, or maybe both at the same time. It could mean that it wasn't taught with the intention of it functioning as a pramana upon the students, and therefore leading them to knowledge.
Yeah.
Or it could mean that there wasn't an explicit mention that, that the Upanishad is a pramana.
That's true. Yeah. It could be either.
What was that again?
That you could be just teaching teaching it as a pramana, but you may not mention in your teaching of it that this is a pramana and this is how to listen to it. That's right. And I don't know with Sri Swamiji about anything about that, actually, because when he was teaching it to me, it did kind of work as a pramana.
It's like an open secret, too.
Yeah.
But for
you're
it
doing
work,
both, actually.
What?
You're doing both when you teach us.
I'm doing both, and Swamiji did both.
Yeah. Because to set up the listening properly, you have to know that this process is working in this format.
Well, it's helpful. I think it's helpful to know that. Also, that's another thing, is you can take, that's a good, really good point. Another thing is like the adhikari. Who is the qualified student? What is viveka, discrimination? What is vairagya, dispassion? Where those are actually unfolded and talked about. What is mumukshutvam? Where Swamiji will go on and on about each one of those. And it does in the Shastra also, in all the Prakarana Granthas. Each one of these, viveka, vairagya, what is shama, dhamma, upadatita, tiksha, shraddha, samadhanam, all of these, one by one, they're all unfolded, stories are told, so that you can see yourself in that and understand yourself, and understand it in relationship to this knowledge. What does it mean to be a mumukshu, to be one who desires liberation? You could just assume that the person's a mumukshu and has this viveka or vairagya and all of these things, because to even be interested in this knowledge, you have to have all of that to enough of a degree to, want to listen. So you do have all of that. But when you unfold it, the student, you recognize all of that in yourself, and the absence also. You see where you are in all of that, and it becomes a value. Because you understand what it is in the context of the whole vision. So it's almost that There's that, and also, if a person comes to this teaching and has this desire for liberation, this mumukshu tum, that means there has been some degree, a high enough degree of assimilation of the problem, the fundamental problem, that there's no possibility of my gaining any type of lasting wholeness from the creation, because everything in the creation is time-bound, so I can't really fulfill myself here. There's no end to the game. You know, it's not like, now if I just had this and this and this, then that would work. You see through all of that. So everybody has reached that point where you kind of realize you're stuck, and you're stuck by the very nature of the creation, and you kind of, you know, throw your hands up to Ishwara. You know, is there liberation? Is there really such a thing? What is that? So everybody has that to a degree enough to bring you to this teaching. But when it's really unfolded, you know, all of that, then you gain a value for it. You see yourself, you recognize your situation, and by the type of unfoldment, the teaching makes you more of a mumukshu, a more defined, chisels out the mumukshutvam.
Yeah, the clarity increases.
Yeah. The clarity of your own mumukshutvam is increased.
You know, going back to the beginning logic that you used of if something comes into being,
yeah,
you know, if it's surrounded by non-existence on both sides, then it doesn't have any actual being,
right?
Except for the being that it takes from
that it borrows from
other order of reality. Right, but you know, when I hear that logic, what occurs to me often is that the issue is that when we're dividing up a seamless totality,
yeah,
that it points to me. It makes me feel, well, the what it's pointing out to me is that the mistake of dividing a seamless reality into seamless totality into discrete, separate, individual things.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But once you say seamless,
mm-hmm,
that's non-dual.
Right.
If you say seamless.
Exactly, yeah.
And
because it even has to be the totality that is seamless has to also not only include all of space, but also all of time,
yeah,
as well.
Right? Yeah. But that's exactly true. That's why you can say, you're looking at this through your eyes. You see this multiplicity, you know, but you're the one that's dividing it up to make it a multiplicity,
right,
rather than just one thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's true.
So but the thing about it is that then it seems to me it's not so even, and this is, I'm not sure if this is right, but
yeah,
you know, that it's not even that it's a another order of reality, because, you know, the other order is sort of to account for consciousness, which can't be objectified in a certain way. But I don't know if I'm being clear, but it seems to me, you know, what it makes me think is a seamless totality, a kind of self-aware seamless totality.
Now, when you say there's not, you have to say, I think, a different order of reality, only in this, we have to see what we mean by this, okay?
Yeah, that's right.
If in this seamless totality, there are things that are coming into being and going out of being.
Or seem to be.
Seemingly.
Right.
Yeah. Well, no, they're not even seemingly, because it's seemingly, but here we are a seer and a seer seeing. So within the seer-seeing duality, you do see things coming into being and going out of being.
Mm-hmm.
But you say it's seeming because the one who's seeing is as seeming as the one that's being seen.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is mitya, mm-hmm, right? But nevertheless, within this mitya that's being experienced, there is change,
mm-hmm,
right? And at the same time, what is actually there is changeless.
Right.
So I see what you're saying. You're saying that these things that are appearing to be different or changing really aren't even there.
Not as discrete entities ever. They just, that's as a practical matter, we see it that way. But
see, we have to go a little bit farther though, because when you say they're not there as discrete entities, just means we can't draw real lines.
Right.
Right, that's totally right. I mean, that's a good argument, and we use that argument. So I know what you're talking about there.
Okay.
But you have to be, if you say that all of this has no being except for consciousness, right? Consciousness, because it's not objectifiable, it's not going through any type of movement.
Right.
This is going through movement.
Yeah.
But you say it's not really there.
Yeah, and the movement isn't really happening. I mean, in terms of the totality,
yes,
there isn't really any movement.
There isn't any.
Yeah.
But from the standpoint of the mitya that we're experiencing, the maya that we're experiencing, it is there.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you have to say, this is here, even though it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Ya ma iti maya.
Mm-hmm.
That which is not, that is. As opposed to total non-existence of this appearance not being here at all. So it's just a way of acknowledging this appearance, which has no being whatsoever apart from consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a difference between just pure conscious being and this appearance, because this appearance you can divide things up.
Okay.
Incorrectly.
Right.
Right. But there's something here to allow a situation where this mistake happens.
Mm.
From the standpoint of consciousness, there's no such situation.
Right. Okay. It's a different way of talking about it. Because, you know, again, it occurs to me then, well, there really are two orders of reality. It's just, there's only one reality, but there is a kind of mistaken way of seeing reality. And then
well,
there is an unmistaken way of seeing reality.
Well, that's true, but what about...
But in terms of experientially, you could say it's like there's two orders of reality, because there is this continually changing flow of events, and then there is something that seems to never change.
Yeah.
Right?
But isn't that the whole point of satyam and nityam, why we use those two terms to exactly differentiate?
That's why. But and another thing I think that makes this clear.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one who has a problem
yeah.
is the one here identified
mm-hmm.
with and involved
yeah.
mm-hmm.
in this.
Mm-hmm.
And this one here is the one that feels the bondage and needs the liberation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even though in reality,
mm-hmm.
for the self, there is no bondage and there is no liberation.
Right.
And there's no problem at all.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
So what did I just learn after you talked?
You're free.
No, seriously.
The thing is, I don't quite get why you are
not clear about
it. Yeah, I don't. I'm not quite sure
what it is that I'm not clear about. Yeah.
Because. Is it more of a Buddhist thing?
It might. I'm wondering if it's a little bit of a influence of a Buddhist interdependent origination.
Yeah, dependent origination.
It's kind of.
But dependent origination works for Maya.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. But the shunyata of what we would call Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is differentiated from that dependent origination of Maya, because Maya is this experience that we're all having. I feel like in Buddhism that Brahman isn't taught, but it's pointed to
mm-hmm.
in the practice as something to be recognized,
mm-hmm.
as shunyata, at least in
yeah,
the Vajrayana.
No, I agree. Yeah.
But that which is Shunyata is free of any type of experience of duality.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't experienced from that standpoint. This can be experienced,
mm-hmm.
and it's looked as shunyata from its own standpoint. It has no essence, no being at all.
Right.
Okay, that's fine.
In terms of mitya, because it's
mitya. It's pure
right.
mitya,
yeah, right.
but they won't acknowledge the satyam.
Right.
That relationship they don't acknowledge, but that is the discovery.
Yeah.
They talk about it differently.
Mm-hmm.
They won't talk about it as Atma or anything like that. They'll talk about it in their description, it'll be more Brahman. Because they use the word Atma for this, the body, mind, sense organs. That's what Atma is used for.
Who's they?
The Buddhists.
Right.
That's why they'll say that this that you think is Atma is
mm-hmm.
not. There is no Atma. This is not an Atma.
Right.
It's
exactly.
an Atma. Okay.
Yeah. It's true.
It's true.
Right.
It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And then the dependent origination of all of these things, including all of this,
yeah.
all of the panchaskandhas, all of it, just everything is interdependent, totally. And that's all clear also. But there's something that needs to be recognized,
mm-hmm.
that there's not this kind of the Upanishad Pramana that is being used as a teaching methodology. They do it differently.
Yeah.
There's something to be that you have to wake up to, which is free of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean.
Well, yeah, and they do in their own way if they talk about nirvana or.
Well, yeah, and when they talk about nirvana.
If they don't just talk about it as extinction of.
If they don't talk about it as
nitya,
extinction.
With
yeah.
And then there's nothing left.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, let me think about it some more. There's some. There's
yeah,
some
because I feel like there's
yeah.
some, almost yeah. like a wanting the Brahman to be mm-hmm. one with the mitya.
Exactly.
As though this mitya is Brahman, which is true.
Yeah.
This mitya is Brahman. This maya is nothing but Brahman is totally free of it.
Yeah.
That's a little part of here, maybe, where
yeah.
there's your wondering.
And also,
about.
Like, in there are some Shunyavadins who talk, even though they talk in terms of two truths, there's emptiness and then there's the whole appearance, so
yeah.
to speak. There are some Shunyavadins who say, no, actually, there's only one truth, which is an inconceivable emptiness, basically.
Which is Brahman.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I think.
But see, if they say that, then
yeah.
then this becomes mitya. Just almost by definition.
Yeah, then, yeah.
So, I mean, I see, like, with the Shunyavadins, it's just so close, but using a different teaching methodology and
mm-hmm.
different pramanas.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So maybe yeah, the way I'm seeing that methodology you're using is almost more somehow influenced by Shunyavada and dependent origination. That's why I sort of respond to it a little bit differently.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah.
So nitya and satyam doesn't exist in Buddhism as a
concept? They don't use the same words. That's
but
why, you know, you have to understand what they're saying, and then you have to really understand. That's what I found the more I study. you have to really understand what they're saying, and then you can say something like, I think when they're saying this,
mm-hmm.
this is how we're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see. More and more, actually.
And most people don't understand it at that level.
No, they don't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But you have to understand both to be able to
right.
to see that.
Also, in some traditions, Buddhist tradition, actually, they don't talk about satya at all. They assume that you will experience that.
Yes, they won't. They don't want to talk
they
about
it.
They
don't,
don't
want
to say the
want
word,
to put
nothing.
A concept to it of any shape
of
or form.
Of any form.
Which
right.
I think it's a limitation that is, in my opinion, not good. But it's like in Vipassana, that's the case.
Yeah.
You know?
And they have a logic for it. And the logic is with the words. And we have to remember that they're using the pramanas they use are protection, perception, and inference. No, there's no Vedic pramana at all. So it's perception and inference. So what that means, when you're limited to that, then the meaning of the words that we have available are called the vachyarthas, the immediate meaning of the word. And so we are able, with our means of knowledge, to understand this creation. And by understanding, through the understanding of this creation, even the Four Noble Truths, we can negate so much. There's so much that we can understand for alleviation of suffering. That's, you know, the Dvadasa Nidana and all that, the 12 links and
right.
all those things. Yeah, yeah. That's all meaningful, actually. But there's no, what they call laksharta, means the implied meaning of the word, to where you can use these words in a teaching methodology to point to something that's there to be recognized. They don't do that. You have to use the teaching methodology they have, the practices that they have, to come to that recognition.
But they're afraid you'll like reify, mm-hmm. It's almost like they're afraid of reifying Brahman, although
exactly.
they wouldn't say it that way. But,
yeah, but that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly
what it. Are they doing to Brahman?
They're afraid if you talk about its nature, you'll make it into an object.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Concept,
yeah.
Yeah. We deify it or something like that.
Objectify it, make it into an object, reify it, you know?
It.
Reify
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And in fact, with the Vedanta, with the teaching, the teacher has to be careful of that. There's so, every teaching methodology is kind of meant to break that apart again. Mm-hmm. You have to keep taking it apart because it's so natural for us to do. That's how we know, by objectifying things.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But that keeps it also... I kind of like that about Vedanta, because it's kind of to the point also, yeah, sure, you need to kind of understand the matrix, but in a way you're not just beating around the bush and you're not quite sure what you're exactly referring
to. No, that's true.
Talking to
it's very, very powerful, but the thing is that unless the teaching methodology is being handled really carefully,
mm-hmm.
that what the Buddhists are afraid of is exactly what happens.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the places where it's the worst, where we get so easily caught, is the word ananda. Ananda is always taken to be a state of mind, an experience to be had, rather than an experience that is non-objectifiable and is the constant.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the whole idea of liberation is working toward a mind that is enjoying the self experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And the mind, it's so hard to get the mind to break that notion.
And then when you have the experience, you know, I've seen that so many times, that you have the experience and then it goes, and then there's a chasing after the experience, which is a huge amount of dukkha for people.
Yeah.
Now you want that experience back that you had for the short time, maybe.
Yeah, because that was just a mental vritti.
Yeah.
It was just a vritti.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's not what it is. But that's exactly right. Yeah, it's very painful then.
It's very painful.
Yeah. And then you're trying to look at it, you know, when you're meditating, you see, this
mm-hmm.
is this. what is it? Yeah.
It's interesting, huh? Advaita Vedanta, in the Vedanta arena, there's a lot that happened with that.
Yeah. There's a lot of, what do you call it, degradation, or I forget the word, there's a word for it. There's something... loses its, it just gets
diluted,
and there's another word, forget it, some nasty word.
I have a question about this. I don't know, but I kind of, I'm curious, like, because you felt this connection to Vedanta really early, like in your early 20s, right? So how did you know already what you were going after? I mean, because of vision, was it just an intuitive sense that you had?
I didn't really know. I was seeking, though. I was seeking and praying.
But were you aware of what you were seeking? Or were you just seeking for understanding?
Understanding, and I knew there was such a thing as some sort of enlightenment or understanding or knowing who God was, knowing why we're here, who we are, and why are we here, and who is God, and all of these things, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I also realized that I couldn't get beyond the opposites.
Uh-huh.
And that was really troubling to me. Like trying to be a good person and then being a bad one. And, yeah, it was very shocking. Trying so hard to do the right thing and doing the wrong thing, you know. Trying to not drink, and then some kids throw a party, and then you're sitting there and you're all sharing Red Mountain, and I'm looking at myself, what am I doing? You know, trying to do yoga asanas and then end up going out and partying or whatever. It was just ridiculous. You know, it's like, you know, and that's not what I wanted. But I didn't want that.
Was there a moment for you when you heard Vedanta that you just immediately
I knew.
I mean,
I knew.
Like, were you just...
That was over. That was over. I went right to India.
I'm sure that
I didn't look back. Yeah. And that was it.
So I mean, it seems like a past life. I mean, I'm sure it...
Well, for all of us.
Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah, I mean, when it clicks so clearly, I think it's always there's something there.
Yeah, it was such a relief. Yeah.